Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week.
The global push into infrastructure, breaking the IPO logjam in tech.
The financial stories that shape our world.
Cutting inflation without losing jobs. Do we need rate cuts? And if so, how many? Investing in a time of geopolitical turmoil.
Through the eyes of the most influential voices.
Ken Rogoff, economist of Harvard. Former FDIC head Sheila Bair. GE CEO Larry Culp. San Francisco Fed President Mary Daly.
Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
The IMF warns about growing U.S. debt as it meets in Washington. Tesla lays off 10% of its employees, and Fed Chair Powell says he wants to wait to be sure about that inflation. This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. This week, Steve Rattner of Willett Advisors on EVs losing their momentum.
The industry has been criticized for decades as being behind, so they really wanted to be ahead of the curve.
And Kathy Marcus of PGIM on timing the commercial real estate market.
June 30th could likely be a very attractive entry point.
We begin with geopolitics. At the top of the news again this week, in the wake of the Iranian strikes against Israel last weekend, and then Israel's drone strikes in retaliation at the end of the week. We asked Ambassador Richard Haas of Centerview Partners and author of the newsletter Home and Away how much escalation we could see.
We're potentially into a cycle of escalation, not definitely. And if it were to happen, I think the most obvious area, other than the emotional reaction to violence there, would be, do the Iranians take steps to close down the Straits of Hormuz?
Did the calculus change, even if subtly, with the role, whether tacit or active, of Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Jordan? Because in retrospect, there are reports that, in fact, that helped with the Israeli defenses, which I think may be something different in that region.
It does, and it shows you just how alienated they are from Iran and how worried they are about the Iranian threat. But at the same time, when Iran is not front and center, and if we recycle back to Gaza or the West Bank, it's difficult for these countries to move closer to Israel, given their differences over the Palestinian issue. So you've almost got a Middle East now that's operating along different fault lines, the Israeli-Iranian one directly, what's happening in Gaza, what's happening in the north, which has gotten worse in the last few days between Israel and Hezbollah.
Many of us follow the news carefully, whether on TV or reading the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, but much of what's going on we don't see. It's below the surface as it were. You were part of that when you were in the State Department with Colin Powell. You've been in those rooms. Give us some sense of what you think may be going on that we don't know about, and particularly what the U.S. role is or should be in this.
Well, the big thing is the U.S. is trying to be reassuring to Israel. At the same time, they're trying to urge them not to respond against Iran. The parallel here, David, is when I was at the White House in 1991. It was the opening days of the Gulf War. Iraqi Scuds were landing on Israel. And we, the Bush administration, Bush 41, prevailed upon the Israelis not to retaliate directly against Iraq. We were worried that could break apart this coalition we had built. But we were in a very strong position then. We had 500,000 American men and women in uniform over in the Middle East. We were at the center of it. The Biden administration does not have that kind of influence over Israel right now. So I think its hand is somewhat weaker.
Turn for a moment, if you would, to Ukraine. There are a lot of reports that the Russians are really putting more and more pressure on Ukrainian forces in the east of the country. And we have this debate going on in the United States and efforts in Europe to try to give more support to Ukraine. How bad is the situation, do you think?
It's bad. It's getting worse. The shortages of munitions, the shortages of equipment it's frustrating. It's tragic. It's irresponsible. Let's be honest. Hopefully, the House of Representatives will correct this and reopen the spigot of aid to Ukraine. And if they do, Ukraine will not be able to liberate Crimea or the eastern lands, but they'll be able to hold the Russians at bay, as they've pretty much done for the best part of the last 2 years. So this is critical. This is critical not just for Ukraine, but for stability in Europe. And this is critical really for stability in the world. Chinese are taking note what we're doing here, and people are judging the United States. You know, when you're a great power, you don't have the luxury of doing things in isolation. What you do on one square of the chessboard affects inevitably how you're perceived by friends and foes alike everywhere else.
Richard, you always take a strategic view of these things, not just tactical. But given what you just said about Ukraine, at this point, realistically, are we, if I can put us together with Ukraine and the Western world, are we playing for a tie rather than a win? As you said, it's unlikely that Ukraine anytime soon is going to liberate the eastern part of the country.
Look, tie is not as good as a win, but it's a hell of a lot better than a loss. And I believe, given Russia's scale, given its war economy, the best Ukraine can get for the foreseeable future through military force is a tie. Then I think over time, and this may have to wait, David, beyond Vladimir Putin, I think Ukraine, if it has close ties to the EU, close ties to NATO, we continue to arm it, can play for a win, not through military liberation, but through diplomacy and the use of economic coercion. So you almost need to break this down in phases. For the foreseeable future, let's get a tie. Let's get a situation where Ukraine can continue to exist as a viable, successful country, where Putin is frustrated. Then over time, we can get Ukraine what's rightfully theirs.
So, Richard, we, of course, try to address long-term investors, big-time investors here at Bloomberg. Give us your best advice that you would give to investors right now. You talk about the Middle East. You talk about Ukraine. By the way, we haven't mentioned China with now new tariffs on Chinese steel coming in an election year. Sure. And we have an election year, which itself may pose some real issues for the United States and even for financial markets. If you're an investor, what do you need to have on your dashboard? What do you need to be most concerned about?
You need to have a seatbelt and keep it fastened, David, more than anything else. Look, you've got the two parties competing over how tough they can be on China, over protectionism to some extent, which is, you know, all problematic and obviously has all sorts of consequences for inflation. The pressure will be to tighten flows across the border, whatever, you know, even though that's a good thing, I would argue, in terms of security. Also, again, that could add to inflationary pressures if we suddenly don't have so much labor that's available. I worry, David, about the 75 days between Election Day and Inauguration Day. That's the period 4 years ago when January 6th happened. Imagine this is a close contest. Imagine we have not just division and dysfunction, but political violence. A lot of people around the world could get unnerved. A lot of foes around the world might see that as a moment of opportunity. And then again, after Inauguration Day, will we be functional or dysfunctional? Is what's happening over this aid bill, is that an exception to the rule? Or will that be the rule after the election? So I think there's lots of issues. And obviously, if Mr. Trump were to win, does he try to undo a lot of the architecture in the world that has served this country well over 75 years?
Richard, it's always so very helpful to talk with you. Thank you. That is Richard Haas of Centerview Partners. Markets spent the week trying to come to terms with that geopolitical risk, but in the end, it may have been the path of the Fed and some doubts about big tech that drove equities as much as anything else, with the S&P 500 down 3% for the week to end at 49.67, dipping below that 5,000 mark for the first time since February, and well below the consensus year-end number of our Bloomberg elves of 51.70. The NASDAQ did even worse, giving up 5.5% on the week, while the yield on the 10-year was up just under 10 basis points to end the week at 4.6%. 6%. To take us through it all, welcome back now Peter Kraus, Chairman and CEO of Aperture Investors. Peter, it's such a delight to have you with us. Thank you. So give us your take on what the markets went through, because we did have the geopolitics at the beginning and the end, and then we had a fair amount of speculation about the Fed in between.
Well, there was some mixture. I agree with that. I do think the geopolitics kind of resolved itself with Israel taking a somewhat modest approach to retaliation to the Iran attack. I think the bigger issue is the combination of how people perceive the Fed's behavior and what the Fed will do over the course of the year and how that interplays with the valuations in the marketplace. Coming into the year, as was true last year, people were quite optimistic that the Fed was going to cut rates. Inflation data actually early in the year looked like it was benign and actually getting better, and then it got strong. And then the Fed said, no, I'm not going to cut rates, and the market ultimately was very unhappy about that. And so what I think we're seeing is people reassessing their positions as a result of the Fed saying, I'm not going to cut rates. There's also a scenario that people believe could be happening, that if the Fed doesn't cut rates, and in fact, companies are reporting weaker earnings, then the Fed may be behind the curve and could create a recession. And that's also causing people to take off risk at the present time. And that may be some of what we see in the tech world.
The Fed says, at least, it's concentrated on full employment and inflation, period. Not so much worrying about what happens to corporations and the consequences of that. Do we believe them? I mean, they haven't been too concerned about loosening financial conditions.
I think right now the economy is relatively strong. And it's actually in the numbers. And I think the Fed, when the economy is strong, actually sticks to those two principles. If the economy really weak, then they would start worrying about the impact that corporations might have on the overall economy if, in fact, they started laying off workers and if, in fact, they had defaults on their securities and we had real chaos in the market and the equity market then would go down dramatically. And then I think the Fed would start paying attention to that indicator as well. But when the market and the economy is relatively strong, the Fed's going to stick to its two principles.
The value of equities, as I understand, is basically a discounted future cash flow, which you expect
generally
to get. and that, it's important what the discount rate is. So if the interest rate's higher, that means the stock value today is lower, particularly with some of the stocks that are expecting it in the out years, not having it right away. Is that a simple explanation of what may be going on right now, that we were going too far, too fast with the equity valuations?
Well, it's certainly part of the explanation, but I think it's maybe a little bit too one side, you know, one indicator, one dimensional. Thank you, one dimensional. I think what we're seeing is more sophisticated than that, or more nuanced than that. I think that earnings are going to go up. The market is reflecting a relatively strong economy. The multiples at which stocks trade, which is related to the discount rate, that may be under pressure a bit. Remember, we had a pretty fast increase in stock prices at the beginning of the year. S&P was up 10%, NASDAQ was up 12 or 13%, even the Dow, which was lagging, was up 5 or 6% in a short period of time. And that's usually what you get for a whole year. So I think that investors are taking a breather effectively, and they're reacting to this lack of Fed enthusiasm for cutting rates. There's also another question of what does the yield curve shape look like? You know, the yield curve shape has been inverted for a very long period of time relative to history. That creates capital allocation that is not efficient, because when you have interest rates in the short end that are higher than interest rates in the long end, investors then don't take risk. In fact, you know, they're piling into shorter rates because they're more attractive than longer rates. That has a tendency to effectively retard economic growth. That's the main point of the Fed actually having an inverted yield curve. But they can't keep it like that forever.
Thank you so much to Peter Kraus. It's really great to have you always. Peter Kraus of Aperture Investors. Coming up, we take a close look at the specific asset class of real estate, commercial and otherwise, with Kathy Marcus of PGIM Real Estate.
A lot of the doom and gloom about the sector has been somewhat overblown.
This is Wall Street Week on Bloomberg.
Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out Public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
This is Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. Commercial real estate investments, at least some of them, have had a hard time of late. But there may be signs that we've seen the worst of it. With news this week that Ken Griffin is going forward with his 62-story office tower on Park Avenue. And Bank of America saying it's seeing losses on its office property loans easing. For the perspective of a major real estate investor, welcome back now Kathy Marcus, co-CEO and global chief operating officer of PGIM Real Estate. Okay, so tell us where we are on the cycle. Last time you were with us, you said it's coming. The repricing is not quite done yet. Where are we on the repricing?
In terms of the repricing, it's about 20% on average across the sectors. And that can range from something like manufactured housing that has had really almost zero declines to office that's closer to 35%. So at PGIM Real Estate, we've projected that by the end of the day, sort of peak to trough, it'll be probably on average 22%. So for a 20, we're very close. And so we're feeling a lot better. And, you know, from my perspective, a lot of the doom and gloom about the sector has been somewhat overblown.
So I'm sure you're not a market timer. At the same time, you have to have some sense of that cycle, because if you wait too long, the prices can come back up and you lose some opportunities. Do you have any sense of where it really makes sense you need to get back in?
We're advising our investors that June 30th could likely be a very attractive entry point. And at that point, it's possible that maybe you're a quarter early, maybe there's one more quarter of some value declines. But in this case, we really believe that it's better to be a quarter early than a quarter late. There's broad consensus that there's a lot of capital on the sidelines that is going to come in as soon as they feel like the values have bottomed.
We've heard some talk about a wall of maturities. Is there a wall of maturities coming where people are going to all have to refinance at the same time and have problems?
There is a wall of maturities. There's lots of different numbers out there. One of the more popular numbers is $2.2 trillion of maturities that are coming somewhere between 2004 and 2007. I've been at this for a little over 35 years. In that time, there have been at least three other times where a wall of maturities was about to crush us any minute, and it never came to fruition. And what happens in real life is very different than what a chart on a piece of paper is going to tell you. The fact is that borrowers get ahead of their maturities. Loans are extended, loans are restructured, and loans are repaid. And even in a very capital-constrained environment like we're in right now, loans are being repaid every day.
We tend in the media to talk about real estate or commercial real estate. But how specific is it? Even within the office space, some offices presumably are created more equal than others.
There's a lot of divergence in the office space, and it's a really good point, because in reality, especially if you look at the public markets are pricing office, the sector broadly, as if it's a very homogenous sector. And it's not a homogenous sector. It's never been a homogenous sector. But right now, it's the least homogenous that it's ever been. And there are, you know, as many people have talked about, winners and losers in the office sector. And what do the winners look like? The winners owners generally have some level of green certification. We've seen recently that there's about a 50% difference in the availability rate in office buildings that have some level of green certification, are close to transit. There's a huge difference in how those assets are faring.
At what point does it make sense to invest in an existing office building to bring it upscale when it comes to things like green and office air quality?
That's actually a very strong strategy right now, and in particular in Europe. In Europe, one of the investment theses that we believe very strongly in is in taking existing office stock in someplace like Paris and investing to make it, enable it to have the ESG certifications that both tenants and then ultimately investors are looking for.
So we've been talking about offices. What about multifamily dwellings? I mean, where does that stand? Because we've seen some sort of a suppression in the building of new homes.
Yes, for sure. We're seeing a suppression in supply of new homes, but also in sales of existing homes, which is really being driven by interest rates. So we have a lot of conviction around the living sectors broadly, and in particular in this idea of people renting for longer, more people renting for longer. So there's a lot of growth in the population cohort that tends to rent single-family dwellings. And single-family dwellings from an ownership perspective are less and less attainable by people because of a lot of trends that we've talked about, this longer, higher for longer interest rate environment, the fact that there's not a lot of supply of new homes. All of that leads to less and less people being able to afford to actually buy a single family home, and therefore they're going to rent one. So historically, the pricing difference, the cost between renting a single family home and owning a single family home has been somewhere in the 30 to 35% range. Now, because of interest rates and the cost of for sale housing, it's closer to 70%. So it's really like an historic delta, and it's going to take a while. It will come down, but we think it's actually going to be years before it even gets close to 40%.
One other topic, and we touched on this last time as well, and that's data centers. Mm-hmm. We hear about data centers an awful lot. Where is that market right now? Is it close to saturation?
I wouldn't say it's close to saturation. From a demand perspective, there's still a tremendous amount of demand. There's a very long lead time in terms of bringing a data center online.
How long?
If you will. It can be years, because first you have to get the power, and then you start building. So it really can be, and there are certain markets in the U.S. where it's years to get the power that you need. And if you think about the investment theses and the demand side, you think about the ubiquity of cloud computing, and you think about the continued adoption of AI, we see a long-term demand fundamental here. And you also, it's very much of a landlord's market right now, and the rental increases have been double digit and are expected to continue.
Okay, thank you so much, Kathy. It's always great to have you with us. Come back again, please. That's Kathy Marcus of PGIM. The news this week of cutbacks at Tesla were just the latest in a series of setbacks in what seemed to be before a steady march toward the world of electric vehicles. To provide some perspective on that world and whether we may have gotten a little bit ahead of ourselves, welcome back now Steve Ratner, Chairman and CEO of Bullet Advisors, who invests the personal and philanthropic assets of our founder and majority shareholder, Michael Bloomberg. Steve, welcome back. Great to have you here.
Thanks so much, David.
Of course, you know the auto industry so well. You took it apart and put it back together for President Obama. In fairness, you know EVs. Where are we? Is it as bad as it looks right now? Because at first it was really the cat's meow, and now the bloom is off the rose.
Look, it's so like so many things. You start something new, people get excited about it. You do get into a little bit of irrational exuberance, to borrow Alan Greenspan's famous phrase, and the world kind of resets. And so that's what's happening. You had a lot of early adopters, you had a lot of enthusiasm, and I think as this has settled down, people have taken a step back and taken a look around. As you know, there's been a much greater emphasis on hybrids, which are doing really well. So people haven't given up the idea of an energy transition. They're just a little worried about EVs, particularly about the range anxiety.
Representative Haley Stevens of Michigan served with Steve Ratner on President Obama's auto task force, and her district outside Detroit has a lot at stake in the move to EVs. She acknowledges that there's some hesitation after an initial spurt, but says it should come as no surprise.
We were never expecting a linear trajectory of growth. We've certainly seen big numbers coming out, 18%, a million EVs sold. Very pleased to see where we are this year, technically over the last year and the year before that. But we realize it's going to be a little bit more of a curve than just that straight linear line.
It's not so much that consumers don't want EVs as it is that they want them at affordable prices, according to J.D. Power Consumer Research.
There are three key factors that consumers look for to transition to an EV. The first is there an EV substitute that meets their needs? The second is, can they afford it? And then the third is, will the infrastructure work for them? So when we break down those first two and we look at where manufacturers really have the most impact, today we compare availability of EVs to ICE, and only 43% of the market is covered with a viable substitute. And that's relative to consumer preferences relative to the segments, the brands, and the price that they want to pay. You know, premium segments have more market coverage at 73%. But now as we're poised to move into that early majority phase, there's just not enough coverage for mass market segments.
If part of the problem with EVs are the prices, why did the big automakers start with the high end of the markets? Steve Ratner says it was understandable given the history of the industry and some of the mistakes made in the past.
Look, I think part of what went on in Detroit specifically is the industry had been criticized for decades as being behind, that it missed SUVs, it missed compacts, it missed this, it missed that. And so they really wanted to be ahead of the curve. And GM, going back to its investment in Cruise and so forth, was determined to be ahead of the curve. I think they also made a determination, which I'm not sure was wrong, that the early buyers were probably going to be high-end people because they had the income, they didn't matter as much, that the cost of the car was greater, they had more commitment perhaps to the energy transition aspect of it. And making an inexpensive EV is tough. It's really tough. Making anything small and inexpensive in Detroit is tough, but EVs especially tough. So I don't think it may not have been absolutely perfectly planned, but you don't get everything 100% right.
There is, of course, a middle course for those in the market for a new car that is environmentally friendly, or at least friendlier.
Last year, EV year-over-year growth was 50%. Plug-in hybrid year-over-year growth was 36%. But EVs outsold plug-in hybrids 4-1. And the reason is because there are a lot more EVs available than plug-in hybrids. You know, there's a consumer element to this question, and then also the manufacturers. Manufacturers have to balance their portfolio and meet the emission requirements. But from a consumer standpoint, we do collect data from both EV owners and plug-in hybrid owners. And our ownership data tells us that overall, consumers are very satisfied with EVs, more so than PHEVs, in almost every category that we measure, and especially in that category of the total cost of ownership. It's much higher satisfaction for EVs. But that said, PHEVs are a great introduction to EVs. And our data shows that 70% of plug-in hybrid owners are very likely to consider stepping up into an EV.
There are people who want to go right into EVs, and as I said, a lot of the early adopters have. And there are others who are committed and believe in climate change, or they just simply want to save money on fuel. Doesn't matter. And they're going to take the hybrid step. Well, you know, hybrids have been around a long time, and they went through their own sort of cycle. They caught on for a little while, and then you kind of forgot about them. And now every car maker is going to have a hybrid version, I think, of most of their cars. And I think it's great for people to have a set of choices.
Steve Ratner is going to be staying with us as we turn to the broader question of investing in a world of higher rates and higher geopolitical risk. That's next on Wall Street Week on Bloomberg.
Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover. and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA, SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
This is Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. Steve Rattner of Willett Advisors is still with us. So, Steve, we love to talk to you about investing. Get your thoughts. You have an awful lot of money you're responsible for putting to work. So give us your sense, particularly right now with higher interest rates for longer, something that you anticipated on Wall Street Week a couple of years ago. It's come to pass. How is that affecting your investment decisions?
Yeah, I think we do have higher interest rates for longer, and we have been cautious about the equity markets for some time. Obviously, that was not completely correct last year and the first few months of this year, but I'm never going to get it exactly right. I feel comfortable with being in a somewhat defensive posture. I think I've said on this program before, we pivoted a lot toward credit because the risk-reward ratio between credit and equities had really narrowed dramatically with interest rates going higher and giving us a lot of opportunity in credit. And that is still our position. The market has remained more resilient in the face of a rising 10-year for the first part of the year than I would have predicted. Last week or so, obviously this month even, the market is certainly taking into account the fact that the probability of Fed rate cuts, I think, is close to zero for the balance of the year. And so we're going to maintain a reasonably defensive position.
What are you anticipating the Fed's going to do?
I would take slight, Larry Summers didn't say exactly what he was, the headline said he said, but what I think he actually said was a 15 to 25% chance that the next move was up. And I'm going to take the other side of that bet. I think for the Fed to raise interest rates in this environment, election year, no election year, let's assume politics aren't even part of it, I think it would take an enormous market upheaval, a revolt against the inflation numbers we're seeing. Now, that said, the inflation numbers are not good. Inflation really does seem stuck in the 3.5% to 4% range. Real wages, nominal wages are rising a bit faster, which is good for real wages, which is good for the real economy, but doesn't really help you get inflation down, may keep it from going up some more. And so the Fed at some point may face a tough choice. There's no question that the economy has been more resilient to higher interest rates than anybody probably would have predicted. And the Fed at some point is going to have to deal with that.
Now, one of the things, invoke Larry one more time, as said on this program more than once, is part of the reason why the economy seems to be more resistant to higher interest rates is because he thinks that neutral rate, which we can't exactly calibrate, is higher than what the Fed thinks it is. Where are you in terms of the longer term, not just what happens this year, but in the longer term, are we looking at a higher interest rate environment and, yes, a higher inflation environment? We're not talking about 2%. We're talking 2.5%. We're talking 3%.
Well, I'm going to leave the theory of all this to Larry and Olivia Blanchard and all the real economists to sit there and debate R star and all this kind of stuff. But look, if you assume inflation is even 2% in the long run, and you assume investors want something like a 2 to 3% term premium for taking the risk of what might happen over a 10-year or 20 or 30-year period, then 4 or 5% interest rate on a risk-free basis is not unreasonable. And so I think we all got a lot spoiled. We're worried about the other side, the secular stagnation side, during the first part of the century. But now we're facing the opposite issue, and I think we have to expect interest rates to stay higher for longer. And that's a shock to the system, especially for first-time homebuyers.
A shock to the system, but one that may explain, perhaps, your tendency to say, let's take a look at credit, because in that world, credit might be a little bit more attractive because there's a higher yield than, for example, stocks that have a higher discount rate. At the same time, as you've said, private credit's really interesting. Is that getting crowded? Because an awful lot of people are talking private credit right now.
It has gotten crowded. Partly, there's always supply and demand, and yes, it has definitely gotten more crowded. I think when we talked about it last time was the sort of the golden moment where you had high base rates and you had high spreads, and we were able to put money to work at 10% on a floating rate basis in really secure credits, and that seemed to us to be an exceptional opportunity. Base rates are still exactly the same, but the spreads have narrowed 100, 200 basis points. A bit the banks have gotten a little less worried about their own situation. They've come back in the market. And as you said, there have been a slew of private equity funds raised out there to do private credit. And the demand hasn't quite been as strong. Private equity is still pretty slow business at the moment. And so the demand hasn't been quite as strong. And so we haven't certainly reduced our private credit or any of our credit, but it's certainly gotten harder to find new things to do to add.
Steve, tell us about geography. We talked about it in the past. We talked about China at various times. Your views have changed somewhat on that, as, by the way, investors' views have changed as I look at the numbers. What is attractive to you now, right now, geographically?
I think the U.S. is still a pretty extraordinary place. The performance of this economy in the face of everything going on here in the world and so on, none of us, as I said, would likely have predicted this. 4% inflation, 3.5%, it's not great, but it's not cataclysmic, and hopefully we can get that down. But, you know, you have decent consumer spending numbers that just came out this week. You have incredible jobs numbers. As I said, you have real wages still going up a bit. I think the tech community has kind of pulled itself together. AI, which we can debate, it's a little bit like EVs. You can debate, is it going to be big, is it going to be medium, whatever, but it's going to be something. And the U.S. is clearly the leader in by a wide margin in AI. And so I still feel very optimistic here. China has become a value stock, basically, that you can buy very quality companies at 10 times P's that are still growing reasonably, and that is just very attractive. The political risk is enormous, and it's scary, and I would certainly not want to be at China at the multiples that were there two or three years ago, and we wouldn't be if they were. I was just in India a few months ago. Definitely, I think they're finally getting it together, but that stock market has had a pretty big run, and so it feels like it's a bit priced to perfection. And Europe, as I've said many times on this show and elsewhere, is really not great for a whole slew of reasons and not getting better. They've just got one challenge after another, and they're not dealing with it terribly well, but they've also got a tough hand to play, and so we've been very, very absent from Europe.
You didn't mention Japan, because we have some people come on the program and say Japan really is an opportunity again, where it wasn't for many, many years. Are you seeing it as a potential opportunity?
I should have mentioned Japan. I was also there in the last 6 or 8 months, and it's a bit like India. It's definitely come back, gotten itself together. For the first time, you've got wages growing, you've got the economy growing. But again, you've got the problem that the stock market does a pretty good job of anticipating this sort of stuff. And so the stock market has had a strong run. And so it makes you, you know, a little cautious. The yen has obviously had a big depreciation against the dollar, which in a way could be attractive if you want to bet on the yen or hedge it, I guess. But so we find Japan interesting, but a bit like India, might be a little bit late to the party.
Steve, it's such a treat having you here. Thank you so much for the time. That's Steve Rattner of Willett Advisors. Conventional wisdom, Paul Krugman writes, very heavily tends to reflect the preferences and the interests of the elite. A fair number of those preferences of the elite are being upset these days, like the preference for investing in iPhones.
The overall theme this time around is a nearly 10% shipment decline on an annual basis for Apple. It's the most significant decline of any of the phone makers they track. It indicates that Samsung is back in the number one global smartphone sales position.
Or the preference for buying a new Tesla, which it turns out isn't strong enough to justify all those employees.
This is a company that ended last year with over 140,000 people. So assuming this is company-wide, we know it's global according to Musk's email to staff, that would be more than 14,000 people.
Things are certainly changing in the oil industry, as
long as most of us can remember, the world has had something of a preference for Middle Eastern oil, judging by how much it's bought. But now we learn the United States has actually passed Saudi Arabia, not to mention Russia, as the largest global oil producer. Speaking of Russia, there was a day when we knew for certain the Republicans were the ones to be the toughest on the Russians.
The ideas of freedom now are on trial. If they don't work, there will be a reversion to not communism, which has failed, but what I call a new despotism, which would pose a mortal danger to the rest of the world, because it would be infected with the virus of Russian imperialism, which of course has been a characteristic of Russian foreign policy for centuries.
But now we have the de facto leader of the grand old party inviting Mr. Putin to invade European countries if they don't pay as much as he'd like on defense.
You didn't pay? You're delinquent? He said, yes, let's say that happened. No, I would not protect you. In fact, I would encourage them to do whatever the hell they want. You got to pay. You got to pay your bills.
And maybe the biggest surprise of them all comes from the world of college sports. Until now, we thought we knew that, for whatever reason, audiences prefer to watch their college basketball played by men rather than women. But thanks in large part to Caitlin Clark, those days are gone. Her University of Iowa Hawkeyes battled South Carolina for the national championship in front of 18.7 million viewers, which was not only more than watched any other men's game, it was the largest audience for any basketball game, men's or women's, amateur or professional, since 2019.
That's the next evolution of college women's basketball.
Now Ms. Clark heads on to start for the Indiana Fever of the WNBA, and we'll all get to see what magic she can work there.
No matter what the opponent was, I prepped the exact same way. I prepared the same way. I brought the same fire. I brought the same energy. And I think that's the biggest thing going into my WNBA career.
That does it for this episode of Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. This is Bloomberg. See you next week.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.